When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Crossover NBA podcast, Chris Mannix and no Howard Beck this week. Howard is choosing now to go on vacation, even when there's a lot going on in the NBA. Got Kevin Durant, his situation still out there. Colin Sexton in Cleveland, under the radar free agent. He is still out there. I'm going to talk about both those teams on this week's episode. I'm going to bring in Brian Lewis, who does a fantastic job covering the Nets for the New York Post. We'll talk about all things KD. And exactly what is the next step in this trade demand for Kevin Durant and what the Nets are going to do. After that, Chris Fedor does an excellent job covering the Cavaliers for Cleveland.com. He'll join me. We'll talk about the Sexton situation. We'll talk about the Cavs' chances of contending next season. And is it possible we could get a third go-round for LeBron James in Cleveland? All that and more on this week's episode. But first, my conversation with Brian Lewis.
This is The Crossover, an NBA show hosted by Sports Illustrated's Chris Mannix and Howard Beck.
It's a whole new level for you and me, Chris, this relationship.
Like and subscribe for the best weekly NBA content these two are capable of.
What does that mean?
Could be the best duo ever.
I don't see how you can beat that.
Here they are, Chris Mannix and Howard Beck.
All right, it is the end of July, and only one team in the NBA still making news, still preventing reporters from going on vacations, from not checking their phones, from not wondering what's going on minute to minute. That is the Brooklyn Nets. We are now about a month removed from the official trade request made by Kevin Durant at the end of June. Still no traction on a deal involving Durant, and at this point, no real idea of exactly what the Brooklyn Nets are going to do. Talk about that and much more. I want to bring in Brian Lewis. Does a great job covering the Nets over at the New York Post. Brian, what's going on, man?
Nothing much, man. I've been trying to pin down Sean Marks to get exactly when his vacation date was so I can line mine up simultaneously. He's been being vague, so.
Good luck with that. So as we sit here at the end of July, big picture, where do you think we are with Kevin Durant?
Well, I think where we are is the Nets have been endeavoring, obviously, to kind of cover their back end, make all of the trade, I don't want to call them inquiries, but to find out exactly what the market value was, what they could get for him. But they certainly haven't given up hope on trying to have cooler heads prevail and try to get him into camp. And they figure if we can get him into camp, maybe we can convince him to change his mind. They haven't given up hope on that. I don't think they've conceded in that. But they do have to prepare for life without him and see exactly what they can get at the moment. What can they get in second offers? What can they get when they loop back around to teams the third time? They have to do all of that.
You know, we're less than a year removed from Kevin Durant signing a four-year contract extension, one with no player option at the end of it, committing as much as he possibly could to the Brooklyn Nets. One of the most outstanding questions I get all the time, and I don't really have an answer for it, is why does Kevin Durant want to be traded? Have you been able to kind of pin down anything that resembles an answer for why Kevin Durant wants out?
I have not. I haven't been able to speak to him directly. I have asked his representation. I've tried to get answers from the Nets. Nobody seems to have a concrete answer as to exactly why he's asked to be traded. Now, we can see other reports, and some of them are diametrically opposed, right? We see people reporting he's so offended that Kyrie Irving didn't get a five-year max deal that he's going to take his ball and go home and storm out. Other people are reporting, well, he's so tired of dealing with this that this was his way of separating himself from Kyrie? I haven't gotten a direct answer. I've gotten people that are in his orbit, or maybe twice removed from his orbit, you know, 2 degrees of Kevin Durant, if you will, saying that this is a reason that he would be interested in leaving. But I haven't been able to prove those, and I haven't been able to get confirmation either from him or from somebody that I would trust directly related to him to confirm those. So I'm obviously I'm not going to put those out there.
Yeah, you're right. It's that you talk to some people and it's, oh, he doesn't want to play with Kyrie Irving anymore. You talk to other people and it's, well, he's just bothered by the Nets' refusal to commit to Kyrie Irving, his friend who he came to Brooklyn with in 2019. They're at completely opposite ends of the opinion spectrum. It's kind of wild out there, and really only Kevin Durant can answer those questions. You mentioned kind of the Nets maybe hoping at some point cooler heads do prevail. What sense do you get for the Nets' appetite of bringing the band back? Because on one hand, you know, you put that team into training camp, and on paper at least, you are a contender, not just in the Eastern Conference, but for an NBA championship. Games aren't won on paper. There's obviously personalities involved, some feelings involved. But do you get any sense what the Nets' appetite is for bringing this team back together, given the current circumstances?
That's a great question. Hopefully, the answer that I'm going to give is, I mean, it'll be nuanced and hopefully it's not too mealy-mouthed, right? I think they had a great appetite for bringing the band back together. You know, like the Blues Brothers getting the band back together. I think they had no appetite for going through what they did last season, right? I think they wanted to bring the people back together. They just wanted some of those people to behave a little differently than they did. Anybody that was around that team for the entirety of last season could tell, despite their best efforts not to say anything stupid, that it was miserable. All right. There were people there that were just done with the way last season went. All right. I think they wanted to bring that roster, or at least some reasonable facsimile of that roster back. They just needed everybody to commit to the bigger picture. Right. And sacrifice some things individually to get there. That's what they wanted. Now, unfortunately, as you see, when they started negotiating with Kyrie, this is how things went. You know, when your representation is family, family tends to can take things a little more personally than somebody who was hired to do a certain job. Those negotiations got a little bit tense. He wanted one thing. He and his camp wanted one thing. The Nets wanted another thing. You would have thought that they could meet in the middle. That didn't happen. And that brings us to at least the situation where we are with Kyrie. Now, I'm not going to sit here and tell you I know definitively that the situation with Kyrie was the end-all be-all in creating the situation with Kevin. But I am saying the Nets were more than happy to bring back this group. They just needed to change the way the group behaved as a whole.
I mean, that Kyrie decision, I mean, even from media day when he wasn't there, then he appeared via Zoom and, you know, he was asked about the vaccine. It just was, the well was poisoned right from the very beginning for that team. And who knows what the ripple effects were. You know, they certainly had an impact on James Harden. Yeah, who knows what the effect is currently on Kevin Durant. On Kyrie Irving, do you look at any decision made, do you think the Nets look at any decision made on Kevin Durant to be inextricably linked to Kyrie Irving? Or, you know, do you think they're separate decisions that are going to be made by Brooklyn?
It's a good question. When I say linked, I think they are inextricably linked in terms of timing. I mean, I don't see a path to moving Kyrie before you have clarity on Kevin Durant. Now, I would say the exception to that is if Kevin Durant gives you one of three answers, and I do not know to a certainty whether he has given the Nets any of these three answers. A, I'm done with this guy. It's me or him. Okay. B, this is my guy, ride or die. You move him, you should move me. Or C, do what you got to do. And I don't know. I don't know whether he has sat, well, you don't need to sit, but whether he's called up Josiah and told him any of those three things, or called up Sean Marks and told him any of those three things. But just logistically, one would think when you're dealing with the size of the contracts, I mean, any Kyrie Irving trade is going to be significant. You're dropping $36 million of salary. That's significant. But it's obviously less important than what you're doing with Kevin Durant. And the timing probably means it's going to follow some sort of decision by Kevin Durant, whatever that decision is. So in that way, I think it's linked. I don't think necessarily the return is linked. I don't think you're saying, I don't think Sean is necessarily saying, well, this is my return for Kevin Durant and I need to form my team. So this is needs to be the kind of return I'm getting for Kyrie. I don't think it's linked that way. I just think it's linked in terms of timing and in terms of sequencing.
What did you make of the, it seemed almost like to be tactically leaked report that there was an offer from Boston involving Jaylen Brown and Derek White and some first round picks in exchange for Kevin Durant. Just whenever I see kind of two outlets push the same thing on the same day, I start to think there's something strategic behind that story coming out.
No, I don't disagree at all. I think that's clearly the case. Frequently, I mean, whether it's that story or, you know, whether it's other stories that, you know, I may have reported or you may have reported, you understand how it works. Mm-hmm. There is usually, I don't want to call it Machiavellian, but there is usually a purpose behind these, both in what the leak is and in what the timings of the leaks are.
Yeah. I mean, what did you make of kind of that report coming out? I mean, like, to me, that was, all right, well, you know, someone in Brooklyn softening. I don't think it came from Boston because they don't need that aggravation with Jaylen Brown.
Why would, yeah.
They don't need that.
They wouldn't want that coming out and Jaylen Brown, you know, getting in his feelings. Yeah.
Yeah, it just makes me wonder, you know, what the Nets are looking for in a deal. Like, how fixated are they on getting high-level players? We know they don't have their draft picks or control of their draft picks for the next few years because of the James Harden deal. And I think that bothers people in Brooklyn. I mean, when Sean Marks took over and the Nets didn't have their draft picks, you would probably know this better than I, but like it felt like Sean Marks didn't care all that much if the Nets bought him out. He didn't do that deal. Like he didn't, that was a Billy King mistake. And, you know, they were fine being bad, forking over whatever they had to fork over to Boston, as long as they did things Sean's way. It just, I get a sense now, Brian, that like they're very concerned about what capital they're handing off to Houston in that James Harden deal.
Well, absolutely. There is, listen, ultimately the results are what the results are, right? Your record is what your record is. But there's a difference between being hired to clean up somebody else's mess and everybody's on the same page that this is somebody else's mess that you are not responsible for, and then making a mess that you have to now clean up. Mm-hmm. Those are two entirely different things. And I get, you know, if your record stinks, your record stinks, or if you're winning, you're winning. But those are two separate scenarios. So, yeah, when Sean came in, while he was never the sort that's just going to publicly be throwing Billy King under the bus, he's looking at it saying, well, this is the hand I'm dealt, and I'm going to do the best I can with it, and I'll figure out how to work within these constraints. That's a difference from having no picks because you've handed them all to the Rockets, and you're watching those picks run up and down the court and dunk all over everybody, and you don't have any picks. That's a different scenario. So I do think they're both concerned with what they have given up to Houston. And of course they have to be, if they were forced to trade Kevin Durant, concerned with what the return is, because that return is going to determine how they rebuild this team, whether it's a, I don't want to say a slow, arduous rebuild, but tearing it down to the studs, or are we going to try to retool as we move? And I'm sure you know as well or better than I, that second option is, that's hard. Mm-hmm. That's a difficult thing to get done. And even if you do get it done, you're probably artificially putting a ceiling on your team.
It would be wild if for like the second time in a decade, the Nets went into a rebuild and were dealing away their own draft picks to another team. That would just be just unprecedented, to say the very least. In New York this week, Kevin Durant had the premiere of the movie he produced, New York City Point Guards, about New York City point guards. Mark Jackson was there, and he had some, he was surprisingly critical of Steve Nash, basically directed some of the blame for the Nets' problems last year at Steve Nash. Now, you do have to take Mark Jackson criticisms with a grain of salt. Mark Jackson has wanted the Nets job in the past. I don't doubt he would want the Nets job in the future or another head coaching job in any NBA spot. But look, I've never been a huge fan of Nash, the head coach, Brian. The Boston series, the Celtics were better, but I thought Ime Udoka coached circles around Nash at different points during that series. We haven't heard much about Nash's future. I mean, you think it's a lock that he's back as head coach next season?
Well, I've learned around this team, I never take anything as a lock at this point. I presume that he will be back. I'm not willing to call anything. I think it's a lock that Sean is safe. Mm-hmm. But I do not necessarily, I wouldn't call Steve being here a lock. I haven't had any indications that they're getting rid of him. I have not heard that from anybody in the organization. But I wouldn't call anything a lock with this team, because anytime you begin to think that it might be, reality comes up and slaps you and reminds you that there's no certain things with the Nets.
Yeah, and look, a season like last can wear on you. I mean, I watched, ironically, one of those years had Kyrie Irving on the team, but I watched Brad Stevens go through it front and center every day in Boston, and he eventually jumped at an opportunity to take a front office job with the Celtics. You talked to Steve Nash every day last year. I mean, the stresses of that season, like, how did you see that affect him? Did it look like it wore on him as well?
Actually, well, you've actually corrected me when I said every single person in there was just miserable by the end of the season. I do have to say Steve Nash might have been the one exception. Now, Steve Nash was tired with the situation and wanted it to be corrected, but he is as unfailingly positive a human being as you ever want to meet. Now, that might be why he was uniquely suited to this, to be able to put up with some of the nonsense that was going on, because I think a lot of coaches would have said, listen, this, I can't do this. This isn't working, right? And I'll be honest with you, when they parted ways with Kenny, and, you know, I get it that that's a firing, but there was some mutual aspect to that. I mean, Kenny was just flat tired. Tired of it. Now, Kenny is probably not as malleable, maybe, as Steve. Like, Steve can put up with some things and still not lose that giddy optimism that he seems to have, right? So I didn't really see it directly affecting his persona with his, you know, shoulders slumped and snapping at people, because that's just not his way. But by the end of the season, when Steve is even pointing out some things and, oh yeah, we need to change this, we need to correct this, we need to alter that, it probably carries even more weight or is even more noticeable, right? I mean, that's like, I don't know, Little Orphan Annie being depressed. Like, you don't see it. It doesn't happen. So when Steve Nash is pointing out some things that need to be corrected, you have a culture problem. There's no other way to say it.
Now, I'll give Steve credit, because, you know, from the very beginning when Kyrie signed there and he did that podcast with KD talking about, well, we don't really have a coach. You know, I'm the coach. He's the coach. That would have sent a lot of coaches into a fury. Absolutely would have. And then at the end of the season, when Kyrie's out there saying me, Kevin, Sean, and Josiah are going to manage this team and exclude Steve Nash, that would have sent a lot of coaches into a fury. Steve Nash has definitely comported himself exceptionally well. My issue has always been with kind of the simplicity of the offense that they seem to run, that Boston had no trouble kind of loading up on Durant, making him shoot a low percentage. And I got to tell you, Brian, like, I was wondering why Cam Thomas wasn't playing at least 5 minutes, 10 minutes a game in that series. Then I watch him in summer league. I'm like, Cam Thomas can't play 5 minutes a game and give Kevin Durant a break in these playoff games. I know he can't defend for shit, but like, you got to play him 5 minutes to keep Kevin from playing 46 minutes a game in some of these games and dragging himself around in the fourth quarter against the number one defense in the NBA.
Listen, I agree with you. Cam should have played more. Now, I get it. I'm looking at the roster and I'm saying, okay, Cam lost time when you got Kyrie back. Then Cam lost, basically got bumped from the rotation when you got Goran, because Steve is desperately out here looking for a veteran that he can trust because Cam didn't defend and Cam didn't pass, even though I know Cam will just get triggered when people ask him about his passing, but it is the reality. One would think Steve will have no choice but to play Cam Moore this year, even if KD and Kyrie are both back, which, whatever. I mean, they very well could be in camp. I don't know how long that lasts, whatever. But yeah, Cam could have played more and probably should have played more. But this is one of the complaints. I mean, we've seen complaints about Steve's rotations. We've seen complaints about his endgame management. We've seen complaints, even as you say, as recently as Boston, about perceived lack of adjustments. You know, and let's be fair, he's essentially an untested, fairly inexperienced coach, because he hadn't even been an assistant, but he at least had really good staff. He had a really, really good staff his first year. Mm-hmm. When you have D'Antoni running your offense and you've got Ime running your defense, that's a staff, mm-hmm. right? Now you've lost that, right? You've lost that. You've had a lot of turnover. And even last year, Jordan Ott was doing a lot of work, a lot of work. Now he's gone to a better job. All right. So you don't have a lot to lean on. And I don't say this with any disrespect to Igor, because we haven't seen him lean on Igor yet. Mm-hmm. But I'm saying the composition of his staff without a proven defensive coordinator, and I guess we're going to call Jacques Vaughn right now the defensive coordinator, and we've seen how that worked. Right, you have a serious issue with this staff from top to bottom. All right, so I don't think this is going to be an easy situation, even if they somehow manage to keep Kevin Durant and Kyrie Irving. If they lose them and he has to be coaching a rebuilding team, that's an issue.
Yeah, I there had to have been people in Brooklyn that cringed a little bit watching Udoka have the success he had in Boston. Not to say that Ime could have coached Brooklyn the same way, because Ime spent 2 months in Boston just, you know, verbally clobbering these guys, like to get them, to break them of these bad habits. And I'm not so sure you can do that with Kevin Durant and Kyrie Irving and the veterans that are on that team, but he's proven to be a really high level coach. And I'm sure some in Brooklyn saw that, you know, when they were watching him as an assistant coach on Steve Nash's staff. Last thing for you. Like, my sense, Brian, is that everyone's kind of retreated to their neutral corners on this. And when I talk to teams that have discussed trades with Brooklyn, they're waiting to see if the Nets do have an appetite for bringing these guys into training camp. Do you feel like that's the next kind of benchmark here for the Nets to either have somebody come forward and beef up their offer, or them to decide, look, it's not tenable. We've got to reduce our asking price, and let's see if we can get a deal done.
Well, I mean, yes, I think that's probably the next reasonable step. Obviously, your initial ask for Kevin Durant is going to be exceptionally high, as well it should be. And yes, there will be a need, presumably, if they want to move him, for them to come off of their initial asks. But I do 100% think there is an appetite to bring them into camp rather than to say, well, Sean's back from his vacation and wherever he went, what's the best offer I have that? Oh, well, I'll take that. I think there's a 0% chance of that happening, because as you correctly point out, this is presuming you are not convincing them all to come back and recommit and sing kumbaya and say, all right, let's go and try to win a championship, right? If they are committed to moving him, the offer has to be huge, or else what's the point? what's the point of tearing down the one chance? Because you really only have, even before this, I said you really had a one-year window to win a championship. Before all of this mess happened, when you looked at their contracts and the way they lined up, you said this is their one window of an opportunity, because I don't know how much Josiah was going to be willing to pay after this season. So really, you had one legitimate chance to take your shot. And I don't know that they have an appetite for breaking that up for nothing or next to nothing. And I don't mean to be, you know, insulting to, you know, to Cam or to Bridges or whatever Phoenix would be offering, but you're ending your shot at being a contender, right? I don't know that they have an appetite to do that for something that doesn't at least set them up in the future to possibly be able to rebuild a contender. So yeah, obviously if Toronto shows up and says, yeah, we'll give you Scotty and we'll give you this and that and all these other things, then, and if Kevin is really entrenched on leaving, you have no choice but to listen and take that seriously. But I would be surprised at this point. If you're asking me today, I'd be surprised if that's not where we're sitting. We're sitting days before training camp, no earth-shattering Herschel Walker offer has been given, that they're expecting these guys to come in and show up in training camp.
Brian Lewis, I feel for you, man. You've got the most difficult beat job left in the business as you wait for this Durant thing to unfold. And make no mistake, Brian, this deal will break when you're on vacation. Like, this, something will happen exactly the wrong time for you for it to happen. There's
well,
no doubt about it.
I'm going to be in Montego Bay from like the 6th to the 11th. So I expect that's exactly when it'll break. I can predict it here.
You'll be at Margaritaville still down there, that bar. I've been there a couple of times. That's you'll be sitting there at Margaritaville when a trade finally breaks. You can read Brian's stuff in the New York Post. Brian, I appreciate your time, man. Thanks for joining me.
Oh, thanks. I appreciate you having me.
When we come back, Chris Fedor of Cleveland.com joins the show. All right, well, the NBA world is wrapped up in what's next for Kevin Durant. There still is a free agent on the market. His name is Colin Sexton. There's an interesting team in the Midwest. It's the Cleveland Cavaliers. A lot going on still in the NBA over the next couple of months, specifically with the Cavs. Talk about that and much more. I want to bring Chris Fedor. Does a terrific job covering the Cavs over at Cleveland.com. Chris, thanks for joining me, man. And I guess let's start right there. Colin Sexton, where do we stand with the restricted free agent?
It's interesting, Chris, because I feel like we stand the same place that we did last year when they had negotiations about a contract extension, and then when this offseason started. Colin Sexton in his camp, now he's represented by Rich Paul as opposed to CAA. Colin in his camp want more than what the Cavs are willing to give at this point in time. So there's a gap that needs to close in order for the two sides to agree to a multi-year contract. I reported recently that the Cavs made him a three-year deal worth around $40 million. And they're thinking, Chris, is, okay, that's more than the mid-level exception. That's more than the qualifying offer. That's more than anyone else is willing to give him right now. And that's the most that we can give him, because the Cavs are about $13 million away from the luxury tax, and they do not want to go into the luxury tax. They do not want to start that luxury tax clock this year. So the Cavs are thinking, this is the best offer that we can give him. Why won't he take this if he doesn't have other offers out there from other teams around the NBA? And they're basically saying the market has spoken, and the interest just isn't there for somebody like Colin Sexton.
Yeah, you mentioned how they talked to Sexton about a deal last year. They played largely without him this year and had great success early on. Maybe would have had more success if they had been able to stay healthy in the second half of the season. Do you think that the way this season played out has influenced what the Cavs think of Sexton, how he fits into their plans, you know, how he fits in with this team long term?
That's a fair question. I would say that that is part of it, for sure. When you have a season where you win 44 games and you get to the play-in tournament and you put the offense in the hands of Darius Garland and he has the kind of season that he has and the Cavs have the kind of season that they have, sure. I mean, I think you start thinking, all right, do we need him? At the same time, I think the Cavs recognize, Chris, that there is value to what Colin brings to the table. They recognize that value. They want him back, but it has to be the right price. It has to make sense. So the complication with him from the very beginning is the same now. What's the valuation for somebody like that? What's the right price for somebody like that, who does bring a scoring element that the Cavs desperately missed at the end of the season and in the play-in tournament, especially when Atlanta was throwing two defenders at Darius Garland because there was nobody else out there that could create their own offense the way that Colin can. So, like, what's the value for that kind of guy who, yes, we like the things that he brings to the table. He's a low-maintenance guy. He fits our culture. He's a hard worker. But he's a non-traditional shooting guard because he's 6'1", and there are defensive issues with him and Garland together, and he's probably going to have a lesser role, and he's going to be in a six-man role if we bring him back because we acquired Caris LeVert at the trade deadline. So it's about finding the right price and putting the right kind of value on everything that the Cavs like about him and other teams around the NBA like him too. He has some things that teams like, but he's also a flawed player. So what's the right number for that kind of guy?
Yeah, I mean, as I see it, like, Sexton's in a really tough spot because, like, he doesn't want that contract, obviously, believes he's worth more, believes he was on track to get more. It wouldn't have surprised me if, when they were dealing with him last summer, if the offers were higher at that point last summer. At the same time, like, signing the qualifying offer is just a massive risk because of what you said there. Like, he's not going to be the starter alongside Darius Garland. That doesn't work. They're better off with a more traditional starting lineup. They're better defensively in that way. And Garland took off last year. He's now going to be a max player on his next deal. So, like, it's just a tough spot for him to be in because he signs that qualifying offer. You know, his minutes are going to go down from what they were before. He's going to have to deal with, like you said, Caris LeVert, other players that are in that mix vying for minutes at those positions. Yes, I agree with you. He can be tremendously valuable as a scorer when needed to be, but that's almost situational, you know, with this team because they're just better as a two, offensively, defensively, they're just better with like a Coro and LeVert and those guys, you know, playing those positions than they are Colin Sexton.
The other thing that has changed, Chris, is the roster itself. Because if we were having this conversation about Colin Sexton a few years ago and his value to the organization and where he ranked among the young players that they were trying to build around, he would have been top two, right? Him and Darius Garland. Well, now all of a sudden, you bring in Mobley. You bring in Jared Allen. You bring in Lauri Markkanen. And Colin Sexton has been pushed further and further down the hierarchy of importance when it comes to retaining the young players. Like, think about this. Last offseason, the Cavs were having conversations with Colin, but they also did something really, really quickly with Jared Allen because they identified Jared Allen as a core piece. And right as free agency opened, they kept him off the market and they gave him a contract of $20 million annually. That's what they valued with Jared Allen. Well, they're not giving Colin that kind of contract because they don't value him the same kind of way because he's not as important as he used to be because he's been bypassed by a lot of these other younger guys that they brought to the team. And on top of all of that, they traded for somebody in Caris LeVert at last year's deadline who brings a lot of the elements that you want from somebody like Colin. So there's a lot of trickiness involved here. And I think a big part of this too, Chris, is going into this offseason, there were only five teams in the NBA with projected salary cap space that could make Colin Sexton the kind of offer that he wanted and the kind of offer that the Cavs would have been queasy about matching. And then all of a sudden, Detroit goes a different direction, right? And then all of a sudden, you have the San Antonio Spurs that draft two guards in the top 25 of the draft. And then, you know, the Indiana Pacers get another guard in Ben Mathurin. So they're just like, all of a sudden, you start to see these quote unquote potential suitors for Colin Sexton vanish slowly. And you're left saying, well, okay, who else is going to pay him in the NBA?
Yeah, it's a conundrum, no question about it. Do you get the sense that both sides are kind of dug in right now with where they are? Because, I mean, you cover it, you're more connected than I am, but every time I kind of check in with people in that orbit, like, I don't hear anything about any kind of movement one way or the other. The Cavs have made their offer. Sexton has said what he wants, and I don't even know how much they're talking right now.
Yeah. There's a pretty significant gap, Chris. That's my understanding of the situation. Coming into this offseason, Colin Sexton and his camp, and he's represented by Rich Paul. And Rich Paul is a ruthless negotiator, and I mean that in the nicest way possible. He fights hard for his clients. He's willing to do some things that other agents aren't willing to do. He's willing to take this thing close to training camp or close to the start of the season in a way that other agents would be queasy about. So coming into this offseason, Colin and his camp wanted starting guard money. They wanted an annual contract with a 2 as opposed to a 1. And the Cavs were never going to go there. So there is a significant gap that they're trying to close if they're going to do a multi-year deal. In fact, I feel like they're so far apart. And the Cavs are $13 million away from the luxury tax. And again, they can make other ancillary moves to create some more financial flexibility. But because of the luxury tax situation, you know, the Cavs are really offering all that they can. They can't go to $15 million annually. They can't go to $18 million annually. They certainly can't go to 20, and they have no desire to go to 20. So I just feel like there's such a significant gap between what Colin and his camp want and what the Cavs feel like, one, he deserves, and two, they can actually offer, that the most realistic outcome at this point in time is him taking the qualifying offer, betting on himself, trying to show that he can be healthy, trying to show that he can be a winning player, trying to show that he can acclimate to this potential six-man role that he would be in, to show that he can be a less usage, still effective player, like all those different things, and then hit unrestricted free agency next offseason when more than half the league is going to have salary cap space. Mm-hmm. So it'll be like a different kind of they feel like it'll be a different kind of market that Colin will be dealing with as opposed to this limited one that he's had to deal with this offseason.
So let's assume that Sexton is back under one contract or another. Last year, I looked at last year, Chris, as a rousing success for Cleveland. They didn't make playoffs, but who cares? Like they got Darius Garland that works, Evan Mobley works, Jared Allen works, the Caris LeVert situation worked. Everything was working for Cleveland last year. Kevin Love, as a sixth man, worked with that team. There really wasn't too much to be disappointed about. What do you think are, I mean, that's a honeymoon type of year. They could do no wrong last year. What do you think are reasonable expectations for the Cavs going into this season?
To further your point, I think the most important thing, Chris, is that Darius worked, Jarrett worked, Evan worked, and they all worked together, right? It's one thing to have these pieces and you feel good about your future pieces, but it's another thing to have those pieces fit, right? Darius and Jarrett combine to form one of the most lethal pick and roll duos in the entire Eastern Conference. So you know that it works with Darius and Jarrett and Evan together. Jarrett and Evan can play together. So the three most important pieces of this renaissance all fit together. Now it's about finding the other pieces around those guys. But I mean, I think it's interesting because coming into this offseason, there was a sense of, from the organization, there was a sense of, we don't know how good we could have been. We don't know how good we can be. And we don't know how good we are because we didn't get that opportunity last year. They lost Colin Sexton. They lost Ricky Rubio. Caris LeVert comes over in a trade and he steps on a teammate's foot on the first practice after All-Star. Jared Allen bangs his finger in a fluke injury, his off finger while trying to block a shot. He banged it on the rim and he missed basically the end of the regular season. So they're looking at it saying there were reasons why we didn't get that locked in playoff spot. There were reasons why we got bounced out of the play-in tournament, out of our control. And I think they're wondering just how good can this group become? And there's a level of unknown and uncertainty because of all the injuries that they dealt with. The team that they were at the beginning of the season is not the team that they were at the end of the season when they got bounced out of the play-in tournament by Brooklyn and Atlanta. So there's a level of unfinished business here. Let's find out just how good we can be. And that's part of the reason why they took the approach that they did this offseason, where they essentially decided to run it back.
Yeah, I mean, it's a really good team and a really fun team. And getting into the playoffs as a full-fledged playoff participant would think be, I think, a big win. Doing it without LeBron James, of course, hasn't been done there for quite some time. And speaking of LeBron, August 4th is when LeBron can extend with the Lakers. I'm envisioning, you know, a slew of Joker memes with "and here we go" once that date passes. And LeBron, of course, doesn't have to extend on that date. He has all season long to extend with the Lakers whenever he wants to. But from the moment if he doesn't extend immediately, Chris, Lakers fans are going to be wondering what his future is going to be. And I'm sure there's going to be plenty of people in Cleveland wondering what his future is going to be. You talk to people with the Cavs all the time. You've covered that team for years. Is there any way to answer the question of what kind of appetite the Cavs have for a third go-round with LeBron James next summer, when they will have a slew of cap space? Kevin Love comes off the books. Caris LeVert comes off the books. You mentioned Darius Garland, represented by Rich Paul. If Colin Sexton's back, represented by Rich Paul. Evan Mobley looks like maybe one of the next big things, a unique pivot or a unique big man in the middle. All they'd really be missing is a small forward with this team. It's almost poetic, Chris, that something like this could actually happen. But what do you think the Cavs' interest in a reunion with LeBron again would be?
I'll put it this way, Chris. This is a team that understands, when LeBron left for Los Angeles, this is a team that understood, we can't just build this franchise around like one guy, make him the entire system, do everything to cater to this one guy. That they tried to do it a different kind of way, and they have. And they're coming off a 44 win season, and they have Darius Garland and Jared Allen and Evan Mobley, and those are the three franchise pillars. At the same time, this isn't the Milwaukee Bucks here, right? This isn't the Golden State Warriors. This is a team that still needs to get better. So if there is an opportunity that presents itself, and LeBron is willing to rejoin in a capacity where not everything has to be about LeBron and they don't have to shake up the entire roster in order to get him, they can keep it mostly intact. They can't turn their back on that level of talent. They can't. Now, there are things about LeBron that obviously you have to do as an organization to bring him on board, and those things can be a pain in the butt, and those things make him complicated at times. But at the end of the day, every organization that he has been with would say, well, it was worth it. Miami would say it was worth it. Cleveland, it was worth it. Los Angeles, it was worth it. Yeah, he can bring drama and he can be a headache. And yeah, we have to work and we have to work under this intense scrutiny and this intense pressure in championship or bust mode constantly. But it's always going to be worth it because he's always made it worth it. So the Cavs aren't sitting here today saying, LeBron, come to our organization, save us, the way that they were in 2014. They feel like they have a good thing going. They feel like there's more upside with this group. They feel like they can be a playoff team this year. They don't feel like they desperately need LeBron like they did in 2014. But if he's willing to come and they can keep the roster intact and they have the cap space to bring him aboard, they're in no position to say no to that caliber player. And I think they know that.
That would be, I mean, I wouldn't even call it surprising at this point. Because
no.
It's like, it just, you add, if LeBron this season is the version we saw last year, there's no reason to believe that there's a cliff for LeBron coming anytime soon. Like, add him to that mix and they're the favorites. They just are. It's simple as that, you know?
Agreed.
And I agree with you. You know, it's a totally different situation than what it was in 2014. That team stunk. And, you know, you had the first pick. We didn't want the first pick because you had LeBron, so you traded for Kevin Love. And the other thing we know about Cleveland, I said this to Kyle Goon last week, like, Dan Gilbert spends. His ownership group has spent over the years. So if it means, like, signing LeBron to cap space, then blowing that cap space to bring Kevin Love back and, you know, bring whatever you need ancillary that can fit under the rules of the salary cap, they're going to be willing to do. And quite frankly, the Lakers have not done that the last couple of years, from Alex Caruso to some of the other things that have gone on in Los Angeles. And that, I'm sure that's that's in the mind of LeBron and his team as they think about their future.
Look, beyond the fact that this is home, Chris, and there's always going to be that kind of appeal to LeBron, this is a really good situation for an aging LeBron at the end of his career. Like, this is part of the reason why he came to the Cavs in 2014. I'm going to eventually pass the torch to somebody like Kyrie. I'm going to give him the blueprint. And then towards the end of my career, it's going to become Kyrie's team, and I'm going to take a little step back. And he goes to Los Angeles, and he's there with AD. And eventually AD was supposed to be the successor, that everything didn't have to be LeBron. LeBron didn't have to be the one that was at the center of everything. He could have that transitional period to the next great star while his career was coming to an end. Like, yes, he would be the best player that the Cavs would have, but they would also have like really, really good pieces around him. So when his career started to tail off more and more and more, and when he was ready to call it quits, he could pass the torch to either Darius Garland or Evan Mobley. And he wouldn't have to be MVP level LeBron every single night for the Cavs to be successful the way that he's had to be for the Lakers because of the variety of injuries and the poor roster construction and all those kinds of things. So I think just from a pure basketball standpoint of what LeBron would want and need towards the end of his career, you would have a hard time finding another situation that would be more appealing with the young talent that the Cavs have than the Cavs.
I agree. I agree completely. You can read Chris's stuff over at cleveland.com. Chris, it's going to be a fun season, I think, in Cleveland for a lot of reasons. And when you get bored, you know, like December, January, you just write the Is LeBron Coming Back story. Get all that traffic that comes with it over on cleveland.com, man.
That's right. Got that in the back pocket, ready to go, Chris.
Thanks for joining me, man. I appreciate it.
You got it, man. Anytime.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.